Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we take The Point on the road to tour the Aquinnah Cultural Center on Martha's Vineyard. We visited the center on a breezy, mild November day. The center is housed in the historic Vanderhoop home overlooking Mashup Beach with no man's land visible in the distance. Brad Lopes, Aquinnah Wampanoag educator, met us at the center, and our tour began in front of a beautiful stone fireplace.
Welcome, everyone, to the Aquinnah Cultural Center. We're currently situated in the Edwin DeRise Vanderhoop House, which is an older house within our Aquinnah Wampanoag community. So this house was built actually around the turn of the century, so really like the late 1800s into the 1900s, and really served as like a household for the Vanderhoop family, which has been a large family, you know, ever since they've joined our community too as well. And so the Vanderhoop name and the Vanderhoop family have called this place home for a long time until it became eventually this museum that we're currently sitting in. So right now we as a museum do a few different things, but we have all of our displays kind of meant to tell the story of the Aquinnah Wampanoag community, whether it is that deep 400 year history with colonization, that 12,000 years of living here on the land, or if it's this more kind of contemporary Vanderhoop history that this house can also speak to. So we do quite a bit of work here, but it's meant to be both a house museum and a history museum. So a museum that both tells you a little bit about that time period that Edwin built this house, they were living in this house, that they were actually, you know, engaged in sewing, playing piano, and those kinds of things. However, at the same time, we have these historical displays, and you'll see a few other things too as well that speak to like that longer history. So placing the context of the house within that longer 12,000 year history. And so that's some of the work that we do like overall as an organization.
Tell us about the photos on the mantle. Who are the folks in the photos?
So right here, we do have, these are two Blaines, but you'll see just by their names, right? So we have Maurice Slocum Blaine. And then on the right, we have Myrtle Evelyn Vanderhoop Blaine. And one of the cool things about this photo is it just shows you the connections between Wampanoag families, right? So we have a Vanderhoop, again, going to be connected to this homestead itself right here. But they're also married into a Blaine family, being a large Wampanoag family. So today, when you see those names, Vanderhoop, Blaine, as well as Slocum, not so much today, you're not going to see Slocum as much, more of a historical Wampanoag name. You're seeing families marry into, you know, again, you're marrying other Wampanoag families, essentially, making bigger families. Sometimes even, too, there's a bunch of couples that are actually married between here and the mainland as well. Another name you're going to see is like Attaquin. Attaquin is a name that's actually shared between island communities and mainland communities. So there's actually Solomon Attaquin in Mashpee, our sister community on the mainland. However, you know, we also have Helen Attaquin, who some of you may even have met when she was alive, who was from our community. So again, those shared kind of marriages to show you that Wampanoag families have usually, you know, married amongst each other. And those names carry that legacy too as well, whether it's Blaine, Slocum, Vanderhoop, you know, Mashpee, you're looking at Pocknett, Peters, all of these really prominent family names that have kind of acted as, these are our clans, right? These are our families. These are how we form kind of a larger group together as the tribe. So kind of carrying that family history and all the things that we do.
Let's walk through and just tell us what we've got.
Absolutely. So I guess I'll speak to just some few things over here first. Blessa Piano, which is actually like the major piece here. But again, this is kind of showing you a little bit about Edwin's house, having the piano here. But we added some kind of key pieces here to contextualize some of it, including photos of us when we became federally recognized. Now, as you can see, there are folks in more Western style regalia during that time period. This was even requested by state officials that we showed up in regalia. So even that was kind of a very interesting dynamic. But below here, we actually have a very important document. This is a copy of one of the Wampanoag Bibles. And these were actually used primarily to convert Wampanoag people in the 1600s. We keep something like this around because it contextualizes, even though, you know, this house is from, you know, the 1800s, 1900s, it contextualizes, like, why are we speaking English in this house right now, as opposed to Wampanoag? And it's also allowed us to help recover the language in a lot of ways, which is the really important work of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project and Jesse Littledoe over there. So some really important kind of stuff that help carry the story, and we're never stuck in just one timeline either. So I think it's 1649, England passes a parliamentary act to actually fund the spreading of the gospel of Jesus Christ amongst the colonies of New England. Once you have the funding in place, Massachusetts Bay, ever since its origin, even in part of their charter, essentially, their goal is to convert native people. However, there's debates on how to really do that. Eliot, for a long time, actually wanted to put all the native people into one community and try to convert them there. However, he started to do that separately, for example, and for a variety of reasons. But the goal was also to effectively convert people without having to teach them the language first. So how do you make these people Christians? So 1709, these start actually being produced. I think it's the first one is 1660 something, and I don't want to quote the exact day. I can't remember off the top of my head. But these are being produced actually primarily out of Cambridge and a few other places, but they're usually attributed to John Eliot. Now, John Eliot was one of the members who is associated with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He is somebody who is also founding these praying towns, such as Natick as well. On the island, we're primarily dealing with Thomas Mayhew, Thomas Mayhew Jr., Experience Mayhew, and Thomas Cotton Jr. And they are using versions of Eliot's Bible, essentially, on the island that he's using on the mainland. However, there are dialect differences between the island and the mainland. And we pick up on most of this actually through some of Cotton's work. Thomas Cotton was writing a journal of a lot of Wampanoag words while he was here. And that's where we're able to see some of those dialect differences too as well. There are some today that are in archival spaces that are from the islands. So there's one I'm looking at in Philadelphia right now, I think is actually was from Gay Head. And it's from the early 1700s. And it was like a copy that they were using every day. And there's actually tons of notes and comments in the margins in Wampanoag. Now, of course, they're using like an English-style alphabet to help write it, but it's Wampanoag that they're using. So it's a very fascinating kind of insight into that time period and that history. We have a few accounts, especially on the island, too, as well. There are some like kind of like anecdotal comments by particularly Thomas Mayhew about some events that occur here, but especially I would say Experience Mayhew. So Experience is actually bilingual. So Experience actually knows Wampanoag and English. Experience writes a book that we have like a copy of over there. That's actually just the dying speeches of Wampanoag people on the island. And they record essentially their story of, in many cases, of them becoming Christian or other kind of components in their family where, say, for example, their parents didn't become Christian, but they did. And so sometimes those narratives and these stories come out through those documents and those recordings, and also later on too as well, because, you know, we're still here. We still have that contemporary experience. And so many people can tell stories about their family kind of gravitating away from the church, those kinds of things too as well.
I'm wondering, because a lot of the history is oral histories passed down, not so much written histories. So how do you have much that's still being passed down in the oral history realm of stories from families?
I mean, we're just always going to be an oral people. And I always say that because, like, if you come to, like, a Wampanoag-style event, you're going to see people talking. It's just a way of being. It's our epistemology. And so even today, I actually joke around about why I prefer audiobooks as opposed to a written book. And just because it's the oral tradition that we have, right? I prefer to have knowledge be transferred through an oratory means as opposed to a written means. And cultures change. You know, some prefer that. Some prefer written versions. And there are other kind of ways of transferring knowledge, too, as well. However, you know, we're still very oral-based people. We try our hardest to record essentially like oral histories of our elders. We do that as an organization here, but I think also just as a tribe, we try to do that within our families, but also just within our tribal structure itself, right? So like making sure that we're constantly recording some of this stuff. It was my, through the cultural center here, I was able to actually hear some of the history of my great-grandfather, Arthur Lopes, for example. And I had never had the chance to meet or hear him. And so even that, now we're able to even record it, and that can transcend generations in a way that's really unique.
Do you speak the language?
Nakis, yes. Only somewhat, but I'm not a fluent speaker, I would describe. I still have many years, maybe even might not be my generation. Might be my son or my children, hopefully. But it will take a while, you know, but actively trying.
We're touring the Aquinnah Cultural Center on Martha's Vineyard with Brad Lopes, Aquinnah Wampanoag educator. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're on the road today getting a tour of the Aquinnah Cultural Center. The Cultural Center is housed in the historic Vanderhoop home overlooking Moshup Beach. Aquinnah Wampanoag educator Brad Lopes is our tour guide.
In this space in particular, I'll talk about just kind of two things, and then we'll head out to the porch area. I want to focus on this case. This case just has a few important cultural material within it. First of all, is a weaved bag. Okay, you can see this is a traditional style of weaving. You're going to see both round and flat bags. There is a few documents that actually talk about the weaves being so tight, especially in the 1600s, where there are vessels that could even hold water. For example.
How old is that one?
I don't know that one off the top of my head. I do know that Tobias Vanderhoop did make it, so I would say it is probably at least a few years old.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely. These are more contemporary creations based on our, you know, continued culture through time, which next to that we have some ties essentially. So these are weaved ties. These are usually used on like your leggings and your regalia just to tie them to your legs. We have moccasin nosh, so shoes. You know, that's where the word moccasin comes from, is the Wampanoag language, moccasin nosh, shoes. Down there, you could see that that's a bowl that was made out of a squash. So you're going to see these different kinds of things. Squash can be used to make bowls, essentially, or cups as well. And as long as you just treat it right afterwards. And we also have a horseshoe crab bag there. Horseshoe crabs are a very important animal to us. They're kind of like our, one of our oldest relatives, we'll quite literally say. And then you have the quahog shells right next to them. So being Aquinnah Wampanoag and just being Wampanoag in general is impossible to separate yourself from the waterways. You know, for folks on the mainland, for Mashpee, for Herring Pond, they're talking about that fresh waterways often in the bays, the salty kind of brackish bays. For us in Aquinnah, a lot of it comes to that salt water, right? And the ocean ways. And that's why oftentimes our community, as well as Mashpee and Herring Pond and other Wampanoag communities, would contribute very quickly to things like the whaling trade, for example. Oftentimes also by force. However, some folks would take advantage of that too as well. So that's a little bit about that. I also just wanted to comment briefly. We did do this display a few years ago that you see here. We usually keep it just around the edge of the walls. And this display was just a way of us kind of quite literally telling the story of colonization through our lens. And colonization, again, for us is an ongoing process. It didn't end, you know, in whatever time. It's an ongoing thing we experience. So we really wanted to bring people to the forefront that, especially here on the islands too as well, we have been interacting actually with outsiders, with Europeans, whatever we want to call it, for quite a long time, even before the arrival of the group commonly called the Pilgrims in 1620. You can even see here we're talking a little bit about the essentially the enslavement of Epinal, who is kidnapped in 1611 by Edward Harlow. Eventually, he's actually brought over to England. He's able to convince them to come back, telling them there's gold here. When he does that, he's not alone, by the way. There are other folks who were kidnapped, some from the mainland. He's able to actually get overboard and back to the island, where he will encounter the English again in 1619, and then again in 1620. So kind of we wanted to tell this story from our lens, and that's something that we really do a lot of, I think, and we are constantly trying to find more opportunities to make sure that things are centered through that lens, too, as well. Let's head out on the porch.
Okay.
So this area right here is very fishing focused, very daily life focused too as well. Over on this shelf, you'll see we actually have some baleen. Okay, that's what's kind of on that second shelf up, whale baleen, yep. So very important to us. Our relationship to the whale is, it's our cousin, it's our family member. They are somebody that like we can recognize, we hear their songs, you know, we relate to that. And so we have a very close relationship with whales. And there was a time period where for many men in our community, though, the only way where you were going to actually basically provide a livelihood for you and your family was to get out on these boats that were part of a much bigger global system that was not even relatively close to our traditional relationship with the whale in many cases. But we keep that around because it's a story about us and our people. Today, even, there are actually many examples of Wampanoag folks who, for various reasons, are in all different kind of points of the globe at different time periods, usually associated with whaling in some way, shape, or form. And so we have been quite all over the place, too, as well. Kind of moving just down a little bit further, you guys can see some whale bones that we currently have. We also have just this fishing display because, again, being in Aquinnah, we've always been fishermen. We will always be fishermen. You can see there's a list there from the 1860 census on the wall of Aquinnah Wampanoag men that are essentially, identified as being whalers too as well. There are several censuses of us from basically almost like very early on after King Philip's War in the 1670s, all the way up until at least the 1860s. And that's because, to be frank, the colonies and the state has always wanted to know where we were and how many of us there were. And that has a lot to do with a variety of factors, but also, especially after the war, where Wampanoag people are essentially forced into a few different places. So you can be in those places, and you surely shouldn't be anywhere else. Gay Head is one of the places where we can kind of be. But even that is, we have to fight for this in lots of cases. And we have been successful, though, because we're still here, and we're always going to be here. But I think about these names a lot because, you know, they're names that we're related to. These are our family in many ways. But you can also see where it connects us to other communities. We're just joking about this because it says Aquinnah Wampanoag Whalers. And then you'll notice there's a Narragansett man on here as well. He's married into the community, right? So traditionally we're matrilineal, matrilocal. Many of us still practice and still walk in that kind of way. And so that means if you're a man, you're joining your wife's community. You're going to come into this community and join it. And you're going to see there are some folks that are, you know, living quite old too as well. Even historically, we lived quite old too. There's plenty of accounts actually of Wampanoag folks living into the, what seems to be at least their 60s up to their 90s in the 1600s as well. But again, that makes sense when you look at our traditional diet. It's very low on any sort of like fatty kind of substances. It's very well-balanced, and you're also living a very extremely physically balanced lifestyle too as well. So like running is a pretty important thing to us. Historically, you're running messages back and forth. You're literally running between communities. And in fact, when like Gosnold is here in 1602, Gosnold is even described as a swift runners. He's uses that kind of phrase more than once, I believe. But you're running around constantly, you know. So that's how we get around. Most of the roads today on the mainland are actually the same exact roads that we have been walking, that we probably helped design and create. Same thing's true for the island in many cases. Here you can see two very famous Wampanoag folks that were on some of those boats. Amos Haskins here. And then this right here is, give me a second, Amos Smalley. That's why it was getting to me because they had the same first name. However, Smalley becomes famous too because he actually will go out and be the person who does kill a white whale during the whaling. Him and Moby Dick, not necessarily associated. However, he definitely was like, I'm going to try to cash in on that movie a little bit. So you do see some of that. Amos is very successful. Amos Haskins is a very successful whaling businessman during a time period where to be who he was and doing what he was is a challenge regardless. And so this is true of Paul Cuffey and a few other folks too that have Wampanoag families that are connected to our communities. I always just like this because it just is like a reminder of like, right? Like,
is this cranberry? Is this for?
No, this is actually a washing machine right here.
A washing machine?
Yep. No worries. So This right here, right? So you're using this to quite literally like wash your clothes frequently. And so you're using all different kinds of devices, all different kinds of like essentially homesteading methods in many ways throughout your lifetime because even Gay Head itself didn't really even receive electricity until about like 50-ish years ago. And even there were folks within the community that didn't want that. Again, kind of wanting to make sure that more people didn't come into the community as well, because it's been a Wampanoag community. And so really important for us to always kind of have that balance. And honestly, like we're completely okay with, I think, kind of maybe not being the most technologically up to date, as long as it also protects our ways of being too. Behind us, again, very important. This is just some of our traditional clay. So if you go down to the Aquinnah clay cliffs, you'll see that they have clay that is actually gray, black, yellow, and this kind of like reddish color that we more associate with clay. And this clay is sacred to us. It is something that is alive and breathing. It is something that's really important. We make vessels out of it. You make beads out of it. but overall too as well. It's just something we also might leave alone sometimes. Today down on the cliffs, for example, tribal citizens are able to harvest the clay. However, non-tribal citizens aren't allowed to. So
also the colors have changed. When you talk to some of the tribal elders, they remember a lot more colors.
Yes, yeah. So the colors have actually started to, for lack of like a better term, like almost fade away. I don't know if it's fading as opposed to like erosion. And so we do know that the cliffs are actually actively like eroding away, largely due to climate change and just the way that the climate has, you know, shifted with that. And so unfortunately, I am concerned that in my own lifetime, the cliffs might look nothing like they did even today. And that's really, really concerning. Even when the English get here, they will make some really radical comments about the cliffs from well off the shore. They call it Dover for a long time because they're like, this is just like the cliffs of Dover. And that alone, I think, is speaks a lot to the beauty of the cliffs, too. But they are currently at risk.
Is this clay behind us? Is that what that is?
Yep. So prior to actually working with it, it does go through a process. So you have to kind of, you know, work the clay before you can even work the clay. And so we're just kind of showing some of that process here as well, which does include quite literally like getting it down to this fine kind of powder level before actually kind of rehydrating it. And then you're able to use it as clay. So there is a little bit of a process to it as well. So that you can't just go down and just grab it and make it. You got to kind of really process it. But that makes sense, you know, right? Because in the Wampanoag world, you got to kind of put in a little bit of work if you expect anything out of it. That's how reciprocity works. And so you're not really expecting just to get it. You know, there's some work to it, too. Today, there are still many folks that kind of like either interact directly with the pottery itself or keep kind of something close by that is just like that. I know for myself, I always kind of have something either nearby or I do have like just literally like a clump just like that at home that I keep kind of nearby to me as well. Because to me, that's like my family right there. And so it's a way of just having that very physical connection too. But very important. A lot of tribes do work with clay. In particular, like our mainland relatives, you know, Mashpee, you know, but also like the Wabanaki folks and other folks too, I'm assuming must work with clay. However, the difference I notice is just color. So oftentimes when they're able to access clay, it's either in a single color and it doesn't, you don't have this same kind of like color display, I think, and sometimes on the mainland. However, clay vessels are pretty commonly found across archaeological sites for us as well. One of the best potters out there is Ramona Peters from Mashpee. And Ramona does do a lot of really powerful work of looking at some of those patterns on some of those older vessels and then kind of using that as inspiration, quite literally, for what we're doing today. Clay is so important. There are references to as well to clay vessels similar to these, obviously. However, large enough that we're talking about a child bathing in them in the 1600s as well. So quite clearly a long tradition of clay usage and expertise as well. Another person who comes to mind is actually Nancy Oakley, who she is Mashpee Wampanoag, but lives up in the Mi'kmaq country up in kind of maritime Canada. And she is also kind of like internationally known like Ramona for her pottery work as well. Carrying a lot of these traditions, you'll see Nancy use things like sweetgrass and integrate other aspects of our non-human relatives into the clay work.
We're talking with Aquinnah Wampanoag educator Brad Lopes at the Aquinnah Cultural Center on Martha's Vineyard. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're at the Aquinnah Cultural Center, learning more about the history and culture of the Aquinnah Wampanoag. Our tour guide is Aquinnah Wampanoag educator Brad Lopes.
So this is like one of my favorite spaces. We've just entered into kind of like the kitchen area of the house. So showing kind of like, this is like probably the most house museum room in some ways, because it really centers on like the kind of cooking and home lifestyle that the Vanderhoof family is experiencing at the turn of the century, right? And so having these robust kind of cooking devices available to us, having the sink available and the plates and bowls, and just really wanted to set up this room to be like it was still them living in it in lots of ways. And so we really kind of wanted it to be more cozy than informational and just have these devices that is like, yeah, somebody was living in here yesterday.
Listen to the wind.
Oh, yeah. So the wind is crazy today. It has been whirling and whipping. And this is definitely a day where traditionally you probably wouldn't want to be out here on the cliffs. You would actually want to be closer inland because it's going to shield you from some of that too as well. A big thing I always like to point out too as well is just this table right here has a pretty cool artifact within it. So that Wampanoag cookery book is small, but it's really potent. And I say that because that was put together, I believe, in the 1980s. And it's primarily recipes from community members and stories from community members. And even though we didn't publish it ourselves directly, it's pretty close to like that right there, because there are recipes for different seasonal aspects of food and stories tied to them. And I think it's really funny because you can see traditions carry through over time as well. And one thing that comes to mind is Helen Adequan is writing about a raccoon like pie, essentially. So like even just, again, folks are using like our pretty much things we've hunted all along in their food, just like that. And so it's really cool for us also to see some of those snapshots. And when you kind of layer something like that on top of like Earl Mills Jr., who wrote like the Wampanoag Cookbook out of Mashpee, or there's another one too recently that another person from Mashpee just wrote. It's just really interesting to see all this like history and culture just layered in all of that kind of cuisine as well. And then obviously you have folks like Sherry Pocknett, who is a James Beard Award winner and an amazing, outstanding chef. And so really doing kind of work in all different kinds of areas to say, hey, you know, Wampanoag culture isn't just like history stuff, isn't just this or that too. It's also food, you know, it's also art, it's also science, you know, it's also mathematics, all of these different kinds of things. That's kind of some of the stuff I do as somebody who works with teachers too as well, is like say like, hey, it's not just within social studies. We can actually have this everywhere, and we really need to. So I think that's going to be a really good kind of lead into our next room.
Okay.
This space for a while was just meant to kind of be like a living space of sorts. And obviously being a house museum too, we don't really have access to the upstairs because we're using it as office space. So we tried to use this for a while actually as a bedroom. And then after a few years, we were kind of like, we need a change. And it felt a little weird having the bedroom down here on the first floor too. However, today we kind of use this again as mostly like a living room space for the family that they would have been using. And we also use it as a way to kind of share a little bit more about our educational materials and our merchandise. And so this is an area that's meant for like kids to come into, be able to grab one of these books too as well, and be able to kind of learn. Our big goal is to always really center Wampanoag voices and authors. Actually, something like, I think it's 87% of literature about Native people is roughly written by non-Native people. So I always would say to my students, right, what if everything ever written about you wasn't really about you? I mean, written from you and your perspective. And being students who are often already in that circumstance, they could relate to that and understand. And so for us, it's really important to make sure that we have Native voices telling these stories, and especially like Wampanoag voices. And so over here, we just have some nice books that kids can come in, they can interact with. We can sit down and read them if we want to. Like, for example, this is one that a lot of people are aware of. Danielle Greendeer, who's Mashpee Wampanoag. This is Kipunamunk Weachman's Thanksgiving Story. So kind of a radically different take and a Native take on that particular day, especially because we're often contacted about this day as well for educators. We want to be there as resources as much as possible. And this really provides a kind of like a K through three almost, if not four and five level book for educators to work with. Really, really great.
But when you talk to people about the real history, right, and the real Thanksgiving, what's the reaction? How do people react to that when they hear some of the history that they may have gone through school and never learned about?
Yeah. You know, I get a variety of reactions. Being somebody who just really likes history, I kind of go back to like the historical aspect of it, right? So even looking at the English who are writing about that particular moment, they really only write about six lines of information. It's very, very scant, very little. Even to them, from what you can interpret, doesn't mean much. It's not a significant event to them necessarily, or at least it doesn't appear to be in their writing. So that's kind of something I always kind of fall back on, is that like even the people that were at this event, that were writing the narrative at this time, did not center it like we're centering it today. So even I kind of try to meet them almost in that English world first. But then also, you know, being somebody that just loves psychology, I just try to sit with like the cognitive dissonance, right, that comes from that. So you have like maybe this one idea about Thanksgiving or that time period, or even us and the English. Usually I see words like friends as well. And it might not actually align with reality, that this is actually quite a tense political situation essentially happening in many cases. And so it's a day that I oftentimes like encourage people to also like lean into, like, we don't have to continue it forward that same exact way. And for many people that are native who still take that day to just be with family, that's what it's about. It's not really about that historiography that is fraught with problems in many cases. And we know from that, that it was, you know, kind of set up to almost create a national mythos of sorts. And so if we're aware of that and we share that with each other, then we don't really have to kind of buy into that mythos. So that's kind of just, you know, I kind of come at it from a very human level too, as well, of being like, oh, I recognize you may not have ever heard this too, because, you know, for many folks, you know, I'm a former public school teacher. Many of the teachers I worked with had never worked with another Native person. I was like the only person they ever had. And so I also recognize, like, you know, you don't have access to all that information.
You bring up such a really good point about having Native voices telling their story, and how many of the stories were written by non-Native people. So how do you incorporate that now with the educators that you work with? How do you help them sort of tweak their curriculum, if you will, or bring more voices in that tell the real history?
Yeah. So working with teachers really to build like long-term relationships with them as well. Well, a big thing that we really focus on, I focus on personally, is like making sure these aren't just one-off things. We don't want to just come in and be like, no, and then disappear. We want to be like, we're here as a resource. We want to sit with your curriculum and as you're developing it. We want to be there as a resource for you so that our voices can be actually not only in the curriculum itself, but in the development of it, in the structuring of it. If we can be involved at the decision-making level at schools, like that's something that we really are looking for. And as a support agent too, like that's a big thing. But working with teachers too, to ensure that they have these relationships with us, with our community, that they understand like how to go about building those relationships too, and how that can quite literally provide like that first person lived experience sometimes into their classroom spaces for their students and for themselves, that can really transcend learning, but then also in a way that carries like a reciprocal relationship with us too. It's not just that you're using a Wampanoag voice because it's convenient. You know, it's somebody you have a real relationship with. It's somebody you're building reciprocity with. And I always remind people, though, like as educators, like we also understand that you're not somebody that's working with $10,000 all the time, you know. But, you know, it's important to really center in reciprocity, right? What are we doing for each other that we can do, you know, especially within the circumstances?
I would imagine, I mean, it's a big challenge when you look at this nationally, right? I think that here in Massachusetts, we have schools who are interested in that history. Yeah. We have schools in other states that are not interested in that history. And how do we get to them?
I guess like to dial it back, I would even, I would encourage the state of Massachusetts to do more, to just be frank, to get started. So my education primarily around teaching was in Wabanaki homeland. So I went to the University of Maine Farmington and graduated there in 2017 with a degree in secondary education. And the relationship I've actually seen with our Wabanaki cousins with the state of Maine is different in many ways. However, there is a law that you're required to teach Wabanaki studies in the state of Maine that they just have started now, 20 years after passing the law, really kind of add a robust component to it. So the Department of Education now has a Wabanaki specialties coordinator, Brianne Lolar, who's a Penobscot citizen from the Penobscot Nation, and who has been working incredibly hard on some amazing curricular resources that I think will actually transcend classrooms. And so I've seen the state of Maine make some investments around Wabanaki education. And I would encourage Massachusetts to keep seeking out opportunities to make a more robust representation of tribal nations. We're not represented currently in DESE or in other state structures like that. So unfortunately, when we're usually pulled into the education conversation, it's after the fact. And there are some movements, I think, in some pilot programs to like kind of involve us in that development. Being an educator myself, I'm always like really encouraging us to like think about ways we can almost like get ahead of that even. So In terms of other states, you know, we just saw one of our elders, Linda Coombs, who many of you might know. She came out with Colonization and the Wampanoag Story, which is a very important book. We have a few copies here. I really like it, too, because it really addresses, like, some middle-aged groups of students, which I think is an area we're always looking for more literature. And that book was actually banned by a series of libraries, I believe, in Texas.
Move to the fiction section.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. And instead of banned, it was moved to the fiction section, which was recently reversed, thankfully. However, that required a lot of like heavy pushing and pressuring, honestly, on various fronts.
It was outrageous.
It was outrageous. And for us, too, as Wampanoag folks, like, and I always think about it from the student perspective, but to even hear that somebody is thinking that our story is fictional is really harmful in lots of ways. Especially considering the work that Linda has done within the region. So a lot of people are probably aware of the fact that, you know, Linda helped develop the Plymouth Patuxent Program, the Boston Children's Museum, and she just has been doing such important, incredible work in all of our lives, hard work for a long time. And so it was really disappointing to kind of see that. And we really push back against any of those kinds of things.
I suppose if there's an upside to this, it's that there was all this opposition to them putting it in the fictional section, the pushback, right?
Yes, which we have seen book sales rise. So there is a little bit of a kind of, you know, a positive to it, I suppose. It did, what's that old phrase, right, about like publicity, right? A lot of publicity could be good, right? Yeah. So like, and I do think, you know, it was something that helps spread the story, helps spread the resource. Especially around this time of year, right? So we sometimes joke around that we get busier in October and November, and it's mostly because we get a lot of requests from people that want to talk to us about Thanksgiving or Halloween. And we really want to talk about those conversations and encourage you to do it all the other rest of the year because...
Come back the rest of the
exactly,
year.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. But like, again, I hope that, you know, maybe one of the positives from that is that more folks in all 50 states are aware of what's going on. And I think a goal of ours and of other tribal nations is also to help educate the general U.S. public that there are 574 federally recognized tribes and a ton of non-federally recognized groups as well. And so, like, there's quite a bit of diversity amongst us. I just gave a talk recently kind of like combating the notion of a Native American, because this is an identity that comes out of the story of colonization in many ways. We're Wampanoag, you know, where we have Narragansett cousins and Wabanaki cousins and Pequot cousins. And it's like we all have different sovereignties. I mean, the same tribal sovereignty, but we're all separate polities or political entities. And so it's really important to also remember that we are sovereign political entities. And that gets lost sometimes in some of the conversation.
Are there schools locally you think are doing a good job of including Wampanoag voices, history, and culture in the curriculum and supporting Wampanoag students?
So we do some work with the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School and just the Martha's Vineyard Public School System. I definitely think that they have a huge need and desire to do some of that important work. And some of the work we're doing right now is to hopefully meet that need as well. I do think they're doing some like pretty good work. My relationship with them is very new still at this point, so but I do see them making the effort, and that is what is really important. In my other role, I also work in our sister community of Mashpee in the education department, so I do work a little bit with some other schools in the mainland. And I would say that I also just maybe want to shout out Mashpee Public Schools and Falmouth Public Schools as well, because they also have done a really good job of building a relationship with the Tribal Education Department in Mashpee and just really supporting like their native students as well. When you go into like Mashpee Middle High School, for example, it's really evident that this is like a Wampanoag presence. So there's posters actually throughout the school where you can see it has the Vernon Lopez, who is the chief who just recently passed away for Mashpee. And it has essentially a welcome statement, but it's in Wampanoag first, then it's in translated into English. They also have an Indian education program that recently they changed the sign up to Indian education room to Wampanoag education room. So they definitely, you can see it's present in the school. I think they have expressed many times a deep, deep desire to do good work.
So tell us about the workshops.
Absolutely. So my background is primarily in secondary education. However, kind of expanded more into just the general field of education now. So our workshop is all about best practices for teachers, and not just teachers too as well. I kind of want to open this up to really anyone, because the goal is that we're really talking about building relationships with Indigenous communities, citizens, and colleagues. And this workshop is inspired by a lot of lived experiences that we've had, myself included, but also other Wampanoag folks, whether it's in the classroom or, for example, in my case, when I was teaching in both a public and private setting. And so in both of those circumstances, I've had some really interesting interactions with colleagues, whether it was, for example, somebody calling a meeting a powwow, for example, or at one point, a colleague of mine made a comment that I was a mutt, talking about our genealogical history. And it was meant jokingly, however, it was offensive. And so I wanted to also provide workshops that really address not only our students' experience, but also our colleagues' experience, because Wampanoag folks should be able to go into this high school or really anywhere in the world and be able to teach and be able to work as a colleague alongside folks without some of these like micro or macro aggressions that we see. So the workshop is very kind of like threefold in a way. So the first part is really about curriculum instruction and assessment. So looking at curriculum and instruction assessment methods and pedagogies that schools and organizations can use when either looking at something or even just working with Indigenous students, colleagues, and communities. And kind of the second portion, I said it was threefold, but the first part that I kind of skipped over was we set the groundwork first, because I think a lot of folks, even going into education myself, don't fully have a great grip of like what is the history of education in the United States? What's the history of teacher education? How have teachers become educated here? And in New England, there's very like tricky history. We've already talked a little bit about like one of those folks who forms the background of our early experiences with quote unquote public education that non-Native people are providing, John Eliot. And so even some of our early experiences with education come in this kind of form of Christian conversion. And then later on with boarding schools and other things like that, which there are Wampanoag people being sent to those schools. Usually we're being labeled by our individual community. So it might say like Mashpee or Marshpee. For us, oftentimes they would actually list us as Pokanoket, which is actually a place on the mainland close to Bristol, Rhode Island. And so realistically, sometimes they'll label Gayhead as well. So we're being put into these kind of settings. So we also wanted to kind of go over some of that background and that history, but also provide like really relevant research to educators that other Native educators are doing, whether it's like Natalie Bauer and like some of her work, but really talking about what are Native folks who are scholars in this field saying about education and public education and our experience with it. So kind of starting with that, then getting into curriculum instruction assessment, methods and pedagogies. And then the last bit is just about building relations. So like, especially being like here on the island, right? I always remind people, I'm like, there's two sovereign entities on the island. Like you have the island itself, Massachusetts, the US, however we want to kind of talk about it, which those two in them themselves are technically two sovereign entities. However, there's a third, there's the tribe. And even the US Constitution recognizes that there is federal, state, foreign, and tribal sovereignty. And I work a lot with civics teachers where I'm saying, how are we getting at that fourth one? Because the kids might know a lot about foreign governments. They might know about like the English British Parliament, for example, but they might not know how a tribal council is formed. And that's a really interesting dynamic because we really need to know that. When I was able to teach civics, when I was at Wiscasset Middle High School in Wabanaki Homelands. We did even look at our constitution from Aquinnah because I wanted the kids to see that, to be able to see that it's not just the state or even the town and the federal government that has this. We have one too, and we are sovereign. We have state-to-state relations with the federal government and technically the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And so I think really having that layered in is really important. But then emphasize like ways that folks can build relationships with the Wampanoag community, because I do think there is some hesitancy, especially for folks that are new, like coming either to our homelands. And by new, I mean like even within like a few generations, and just are hesitant to engage because they want to be respectful, and they're not taught necessarily how to do that. And so really going over how they might engage in powwow, you know, how they might do things that are beyond powwow to get to know the tribe and other families within the tribe too as well. But how to do that in a way that centers humanity, to not also like other us in the process too. So really trying to have good resources and conversations for educators and organizations that really want to do better here on the island. But we just recently, very excitingly, added actually a virtual option too. So the first workshop was in October and was in person. And we did have over 20 folks attended. I want to say like over 30, but I don't have the number off the top of my head. I don't want to misquote it. But we had a full room and it was really great. We have a bunch of folks signed up for our November 10th workshop, which is in person at the Aquinnah Town Hall. It's not going to be right here. We don't have space, but it will be down at the Town Hall. And it's going to be 5:30 to 7:30. Our virtual one is actually Monday, December 9th from 5:30 to 7:30 as well. And you can register for it on our website. There's no tricky process with it, really. We really want as many folks to be able to attend, especially this virtual session, that weren't able to make it to these first two in-person sessions. And really want to encourage folks from like Nantucket, you know, from also the Cape as well, to come to this. Come check it out because, you know, these are all Wampanoag homelands. And so having a really good foundation in some of this stuff, especially because you can't get it elsewhere, I think is really important. So we hope to have as many folks come as possible. And then also it's a relationship building moment, you know, for us and for us to kind of carry it forward. So, and we're also looking at, you know, exploring some other learning opportunities as we kind of grow and we look towards the future. So whether that's developing like PLCs, so professional learning communities, we're even, you know, exploring whether or not we as an institution could either partner with or ourselves actually deliver professional development points in our trainings. So teachers, you know, really can walk away not only with the knowledge and experience, but also something that the state is asking them for on their licensure. So really wanting to, you know, meet teachers where they're at too as well is a big deal for us. You know, there's always been Wampanoag teachers around. Unfortunately, right now, there doesn't seem to be many on the island. There are some I'm aware of on the Cape as well. So also trying to encourage folks to like ask, why is this the case? Why don't we have more teachers to represent us too in these cases? And encourage our kids to become teachers, you know, become administrators too as well. I'm very often inspired by Helen Manning. Her book, Moshup's Footsteps, is behind us over there because Helen was one of the teachers from the one room schoolhouse here in Gayhead. She's one of the teachers. She moved on after that to teach again. But having her as a teacher, when you listen to some of the folks that were able to have that experience, is powerful because they had somebody that understood them. They had somebody that looked at them and they were like, oh, it's Miss Manning. You know, we know her like she knows us. And this intimate cultural level, too. Which I think can be really, really important. Research even, you know, shows that kids that have a teacher that they can relate to an identity, they do better, you know? And I think a lot of our kids are looking for that.
Seeing themselves.
Exactly. So we really want to kind of do our best to give teachers as many tools as possible, but then encourage them to also be change makers within the career field too itself.
Brad Lopes is an Aquinnah educator at the Aquinnah Cultural Center. He's leading best practices workshops for working with Indigenous content, citizens, and communities. There'll be an in-person workshop on Sunday, November 10th, and a virtual workshop on Monday, December 9th. The workshops are open to everyone, but require registration. We'll post a link with more information about the workshops and the Aquinnah Cultural Center at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.